how remarkably lucky I was to have been there. I've often thought that for me and my purposes and aspirations, it was the best place in the world. I couldn't want it to have been any different from what it was. Robert Penn Warren. 1. The Newcomers. A New York jazz critic traveled down to Nashville in the 1960s on assignment for a national magazine. He was supposed to focus on the music industry there, but the city so offended his uptown sensibilities that his disgust infected every paragraph. "Nashville is a pallid, tasteless town," he complained as he took aim at the city's replica of the Parthenon in Centennial Park, and which to him symbolized hillbilly pretension, or, at the very least, a mind-boggling lack of imagination. And then he attacked the quality of Nashville's food, urging visiting New Yorkers to bring their own canned goods because the city's restaurant fare soured the stomach. Such criticism frequently rained on Nashville. Music executives visiting from New York and Los Angeles groused about its Bible Belt ban on the sale of liquor by the glass. When Veeps from RCA poured in for the funeral of legendary country crooner Jim Reeves in 1964, hometown singer Eddie Arnold had to pay a state trooper to fetch moonshine whiskey for their hotel room parties. Even folks from elsewhere in the South raised an eyebrow at the city. Writer Larry L. King, a native Texan, arrived at the Ryman Auditorium, home of the Grand Ole Opry, in 1968 and gasped at the surrounding neighborhood. "It is located in a section of Nashville with much to be modest about. Curio shops dealing in sweetheart pillows and crockery painted with kitchen prayers, lunch counters, garages, a barber college, and a series of beer parlors specializing in rollicking jukeboxes, dried beef snacks, and 30-cent suds." While freelance writers snickered, sons and daughters of Nashville, too, bristled from time to time. Teens who watched the police's smothering presence at local rock and roll shows, housewives who searched in vain for food products advertised on national television but never available in their local grocery stores, and earnest music fans who groaned about the boxed-in musical formats on daytime AM radio. Young people who showed up for classes at the city's hallowed Vanderbilt University marveled at campus concerts featuring passé artists such as the Platters and local country pop princess Skeeter Davis, when most of young America was discovering Jefferson Airplane and Sly and the Family Stone. In the 1960s, Vanderbilt saw pro-Vietnam demonstrations and expelled James Lawson, a black divinity student who dared to act against desegregation in the city. "Nashville certainly was no hotbed of liberal or progressive ideas," says a Vanderbilt alumnus who attended in the 1960s and considered himself part of the counterculture. "In fact, it was the exact opposite. It was a very uptight town and everything was completely kept under wraps. There was a huge influence from the church. The Southern Baptist Convention was based in Nashville. We tried to keep out of sight as much as possible." But a few Nashvillians chanced to show themselves when it counted most. Despite the dismissive magazine articles that appeared in national magazines and the conservative leadership at Vanderbilt University, a modest social awakening took hold in Nashville in the 1960s. Some middle-class white kids joined protests organized by the scrawny Nashville Committee for Alternatives to the War, or slipped out to North Nashville, the center of black life, to see why riots flared up there in 1967. Their black counterparts joined voter registration drives and sat in and boycotted in pursuit of civil rights. Contrary to popular memory, Nashville had long been relatively progressive on race, especially compared to Memphis to the west, a city shaped by plantation traditions. The Nashville Tennessean newspaper had successfully railed against the poll tax, and blacks served on city council and the school board. And when public schools finally began desegregating on September 9, 1957, 3 years after Brown v. Board of Education, Nashville avoided most of the mob rule and political posturing that had descended on Little Rock, Arkansas 1 week earlier. Still, mixing of the races in schools would plod along at the rate of one grade per year. A few segregationists in Nashville harassed black students, and on September 10th, Somebody in the night dynamited an integrated school in East Nashville, but nobody was killed or injured. Unlike Arkansas Governor Orville Faubus, Nashville Mayor Ben West publicly discouraged obstructionists who vowed to fight Brown to the last. Some tied Nashville's relative tolerance in those days to its River City tradition and hilly terrain, which means it accommodated newcomers and never depended on slavery as much as its neighbors to the south and west did.